There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that is a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Sunday, the 1st of March.
One big story this morning coming out of the weekend has been market reaction to the coronavirus and the way that markets have basically assimilated the news that it's now not just an Asian problem, it is very much a European one as well.
Yeah, we've been looking at the reaction of international markets, a so-called correction on Wall Street and in Europe. That is markets falling 10% from peak to trough. Normally they take weeks or months. We've had one on Wall Street in just 7 days, and that has never, ever happened before. That is perhaps to be expected in times of uncertainty.
We were in a pretty good place market-wise beforehand. I mean, we were at historic highs. It's still a bull market. Let's keep this in perspective.
Precisely. And there's a risk-off trade. Everyone suddenly gets worried, concerned that the coronavirus will hurt the economy. You sell stocks. You kind of expect that's how markets work.
And people have been saying that the run the markets were having is unsustainable since before we were even mentioning the coronavirus, before there was a C word.
Exactly, yeah. Just last week you had Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs saying they may be a little bit toppy. So that kind of follows the usual playbook. The really weird one, though, is gold, because gold is not doing what you'd expect. What you expect gold to do when everyone's running for the hills, you expect gold to rally. You expect the gold price to increase. It's a safe haven. But Brandy, that hasn't happened.
No, not at all. Goldman Sachs has been predicting $1,800 an ounce for gold. Let me tell you where gold is. In its biggest slide, by the way, in 7 years, we've got spot gold at $1,585 this morning. Who are you going to call?
Jeff Rhodes.
Absolutely. There's only one man we turn to in times like this. It is our gold expert, Jeff Rhodes. And we just had one very simple question for him, which was, what on earth is going on?
Equities before the coronavirus-driven sell-off, there was a warning from both Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan that equities were way overbought and vulnerable on the downside. So we did see that. You know, we saw the carnage at the end of last week. So why did gold fall 7% in one day? It's simply margin calls. So when you're running positions, either cash paid or leverage positions, and largely in equities, and that's what drove the massive rally in equities over the last year or so, once the market turns and you're losing money and you have to cash in your chips, it includes gold. And so what we saw selling of gold. And of course, we've seen record longs in gold positions over the last few months. And you have to sell the gold to pay for the cash margin. And it's no more, no less than that. It's not simple, but if you're holding a long position and you're losing a lot of money on your equities, you have to liquidate that position to pay for the losses in the equity markets.
So there's Jeff's take on it. It's not a gold problem, it's a stock problem. It's paying for those margins. Right, we said then, look at this Goldman Sachs prediction, $1,800 an ounce. Will we actually see gold rising and acting as a safe haven?
In the global financial crisis in 2008, the first move for gold was from $1,000 down to $700 because of margin calls in equities. Then what happened? Gold rallied from 700 all the way to 1920 in September 2011. And so I see a close similarity to what happened then. So this sell-off, there may be more to come. It could easily, you know, move another $50 to $100 on the downside. But this is a precursor to a period of very low interest rates, because the Fed almost certainly will be cutting. It might cut more aggressively than it had considered necessary just to help the global economy recover. That is good for gold. So low interest rates, good for gold. I think this could be the beginning of actually a major rally. And I don't think Goldman Sachs are wrong at all. In fact, some pundits are looking for a price north of $2,000. I think maybe a bit lower, maybe some more margin call selling, but eventually it will turn around, because interest rates less than 1%, which where they could go, would be very good for the gold price.
So that's what's been happening to the gold price. We know what's been happening on international markets. What about the local markets? What's been happening and what can we as investors do about it? Mohammed Ali Yassin, Chief Strategy Officer at Al Dhabi Capital, veteran of these markets. And I said that while the major US markets had seen a 12% sell-off, actually here in the UAE it's been more restrained. Some stocks have been sold off, but the major market indices haven't fallen off a cliff. I asked Mohammed why that is.
Well, I think we started, the pain has started a little bit early last week. We saw our markets trying to correct slowly. But I think it was measured, and I think it is really it was more realistic. And I honestly believe, of course, everybody's worried today how the markets are going to open today after what we saw in the U.S. over the last week. But I really believe that today it's really we have seen the if you want, the worries that they started in some other parts of the world. We've seen it earlier, and we should be able to handle this a little bit better, although the pressure from foreign institutional investors could be high initially.
The question then is, let's look for opportunities in this, which sounds perhaps a little bit callous, but investors have to do something with their money. So I said to Mo Yassin, given what's happened, if I gave you $1 million now, following a sell-off of sorts here in the Middle East, if I gave you $1 million to invest in this region, what would you buy?
Honestly, I would start with the UAE. One, maybe because I'm, of course, I know it very well, but also because I think the transparency in terms of communicating the virus and how it's going to be handled and how the precautionary measures have been taken gives me comfort that they are on top of things. And we were one of the first countries that announced it. So, and also, we are the cheapest in terms of the region, and therefore, I would go into many sectors that I would start to build in, whether it is, as I said, the yielding stocks. So I'm going to go in the defensive sector, try to get some returns on that 1 million dirham. And I think you can get like 5 to 6% just out of dividend yield in the next 3 to 6 months. Any capital appreciation will be a bonus.
Mohammed Ali Yassin, Chief Strategy Officer at Al Dhabi Capital. Thank you very much to everyone who's got in touch with us this morning to say whether or not you're seeing an impact on your business. A number of people talking about supply chains, a number of people talking to us about a cap, if you like, a crackdown on non-essential business travel. We know globally that a lot of the big brands, a lot of the big names are pulling unnecessary business travel. Safety first. If you are a massive multinational, it's what you have to do, isn't it?
It is what you have to do, and it makes perfect sense for you as an individual organisation. However, for the macro economy, it has significant implications when everyone stops their international travel for their executives. The knock-on impact for the tourism industry employs 10% of people worldwide. For the aviation industry, 27% of GDP here in Dubai, it does have a knock-on effect.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm just looking at some stories this morning. Estee Lauder, BP, BMW are amongst the companies that have suspended business travel to any countries with outbreaks of the virus. A lot of people self-quarantining as well. I tell you the saddest thing that I did see, though, over the last couple of weeks going through an airport. And I know it's something that the agenda touched on a wee while ago. But there was a girl on the travelator in front of me wearing a face mask. And written across it, she had written, "I am from Taiwan." And so I said to her, "Hello, why have you done that?" And she said, "Well, because people are a bit scared of me. And so I want them to know I'm not from China."
It is, yeah, the human reaction has not always been as we would want and hope.
No. As a species, I think not our finest hour.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Staying with the coronavirus, let's find out what it means for us in this part of the world. Khatija Haque is head of MENA research at Emirates NBD, and she's with us in the studio. Morning, Khatija.
Good morning, Richard.
So what it says on your business card is head of MENA research. It's your job to figure out what this means for us. What have you learned?
Well, it's going to mean quite a lot, not just for the UAE, but for the whole region. It's very difficult at this point to say it's going to mean X percentage points of GDP, because it's a bit of like, you know, how long is a piece of string? We don't yet know how long this is going to continue for, how big the disruptions are going to be to both the oil and the non-oil sector. But what we try and do is identify where the vulnerabilities are and try and assess what the risks are. So when we look at the UAE and, in fact, the rest of the GCC oil exporters, we look at two aspects, the oil and the non-oil side of the economy. Now, we know for sure that, OPEC is almost certainly going to decide to deepen or extend the existing production cuts when they meet later this week. Depending on how far they go with those production cuts, it means that the oil sectors for GCC countries are probably going to contract this year. And that means a downwind on total GDP growth. So that's the first channel of transmission, if you like. The second channel of transmission is the non-oil side of the economy. And here, the UAE is probably a bit more vulnerable than other countries in the region because we have the most open economy. We have the most diversified economy. Ordinarily, that would be a good thing. But it does mean that when there's a global shock, the UAE is quite vulnerable to that as well. So we look at things like the sectors which are most exposed, clearly trade and logistics or transport and logistics, international trade, tourism and hospitality. And then there are knock-on effects then to retail and other services as well. And on all of those, we're likely to see a hit at least in the first quarter. If it's mitigated or contained to, you know, the first quarter, then we could very easily see a nice pickup in the rest of the year. But until we know how long this is going to continue for, it's very hard to put a figure on the extent of the impact, if you like.
So that's on the demand side, weaker demand for hotel nights, weaker demand for plane travel and many, many other things. What about the supply shock that we've all been reading and hearing about a lot more? The fact that China is a big supplier of building materials, as Brandy mentioned, everything from children's clothes to air conditioners. How significant is that?
So the data that we've been seeing out of China suggests that things are already starting to normalize there. So Bloomberg looks at overall factory activity in China, and they indicated that last week capacity was at around 60, or activity was around 60-70% of normal operating capacity, and that was up significantly from the week before. They also noted that big businesses were actually probably closer to 80% in terms of operating capacity. So that suggests that yes, there was a sharp shock in February in China in terms of the impact on output. Clearly, the PMI is indicative of that drop in output and drop in business because factories shut down, people stopped moving around. But that seems to be normalizing now. And so I think from that perspective, the impact shouldn't be too severe. But what we're seeing now is that rolling quarantine or that rolling disruption moving into Europe. And we're starting to see some cases in the US as well. So the question is, how are authorities going to respond to that? Are they going to take the hard approach that China did and simply try and lock down areas where the virus is appearing? If they do that, then clearly economic activity in those areas is going to be disrupted for the time that it's locked down. And that's the uncertainty, is whether we're going to see the same kind of disruptions to the supply chain in other countries as we've seen in China.
So what kind of economic policy response can we expect here in the UAE and the GCC? You've talked about one area of policy response, which is cutting oil production to try and prop up the price. And we've got an OPEC meeting later on. Sahil Al-Masrawi, our energy minister, will be there. But what else can we expect from either the finance ministry in terms of spending, the central bank in terms of monetary policy or interest rate cuts?
Well, the central bank can't do anything in terms of monetary policy or interest rate cuts because we have a pegged exchange rate. But the market is now pricing in 4 25 basis point rate cuts from the Federal Reserve this year. That's a full
4.
That is what was being priced in at the end of Friday's session. So if you look at January, where there was one rate cut priced in for the whole year, we're now at potentially 4. That's not to say that that's actually going to happen, but that is what the market is pricing in. We also had, as you said earlier, an exceptional statement by Chairman Powell at the end of, well, close to the end of Friday's session, saying that the Federal Reserve would do whatever it takes to support the U.S. economy. So that is indicative of a shift in stance, I think, by the Federal Reserve. March is now on the table for a rate cut by the Federal Reserve. And as soon as they do cut rates, then the UAE's rates will follow suit. So we are expecting some support from monetary policy. The question is, how effective is that going to be? It's not really going to address the supply shock. except to the extent that it allows businesses perhaps to access financing more cheaply. And it allows them to try and see through, some of the difficulties that they'll be experiencing through these disruptions. But a lot of other governments are now talking about fiscal stimulus. So we've had in Hong Kong the announcement of a 10,000 Hong Kong dollar cash disbursement to every permanent resident over 18 years of age in the next budget. We're starting to see talks about increased spending in the Eurozone. And I think that's really what governments need to look at now, because they need to try and help businesses that have been affected by this slowdown to basically survive through it. So whether that means tax relief, whether it means some kind of targeted subsidy or low interest rate for borrowing, access to financing, not calling loans, it's all these sorts of things which I think are fairly short term in nature, but would be tremendously helpful.
20 seconds. Do governments like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain and the GCC, do they have the firepower to do something like that?
They absolutely have the firepower to do it, especially the UAE. We're looking at a country which has had very little in terms of budget deficits over the last several years. And so, you know, there is absolutely room to spend more. The question is how and where.
Khatija Haque, head of MENA research at Emirates NBD. Fascinating talking to you at all times, but particularly at the moment. Appreciate your insights.
You're very welcome.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Not if you're in New York as of today.
Banning plastic bags. It comes into force literally 1st of March. You've just come back from a country that introduced it about 8 weeks ago. And the point we're making is, should we do it here in the UAE? Is this an idea whose time has now arrived? Lots and lots of messages about this morning, Brandy.
Yeah, absolutely. My vote is that it is a yes. There's been a lot of lobbying in New York. The plastics industry not happy about the ban that is coming into force today, saying it's going to help hurt small businesses, it's going to hurt the bodegas, it's going to hurt people who can't necessarily afford alternatives. There's talk of charging 5 cents a paper bag in the US. If you're like me and you grew up on US television, as in, I didn't grow up on US television, obviously, but grew up watching US television, everyone always seemed to be paper bagging their groceries anyway.
Yes, it always seemed to me, I don't think paper bags are the solution, I have to say. They break, you get a tiny bit of water on them, they're going to disintegrate and your groceries go all over the floor. The solution is not disposable paper bags. The solution is non-disposable bags that we reuse again and again and again and again.
And a change in habits. And when it comes to debates here on the Business Breakfast, I feel like I tend to usually be the softer, let's be nice to everyone one, and you tend to be a little bit more draconian, shall we say. But on this one, I am taking a hard line because there was a ban that came into force in Mexico City on the 1st of January, although I've seen it in every city that I have been in Mexico in the last 3 weeks. No more plastic bags. That's it. And people are coping. So I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for the lobby that sort of says, oh, no, but it takes time and we have to find alternatives and manufacturing and blah, blah, blah. If you just say, that's it, people will come up with alternatives. In Mexico, it tends to be paper bags for small purchases. And there are signs up in all the supermarkets saying, in accordance with the law, there are no plastic bags. A lot of them have started selling the more permanent, colourful Mexican market bags. I bought a couple. I've come in with them this morning. They also make good beach bags. So they're using more permanent alternatives. But the point is, they're coping. Didn't see anyone walking around juggling 12 oranges and dropping three.
We've had lots of messages about this today. Keep them coming. Senior manager from one of the UAE's top supermarket chains has been in touch saying, morning, guys, totally agree your thoughts re-legislation on bags. We have decided, based on customer feedback, that we cannot wait for the legislation on our rolling out charging on bags in April. Recycled paper bag alternatives are already on sale and we are pushing ahead because an important number of customers are demanding action. It's a brave decision. We know that Carrefour trialled this at a few supermarkets a couple of years ago and saw a significant decrease in business. People just went to a different supermarket. That's how important it was, because they had a choice. But I'm with you, Brandy. If you take choice out of the equation, then Lulu or Carrefour or Spinneys or Troitrims or whoever it may be doesn't have to act unilaterally and risk seeing a decrease in business. If it's the same for everyone, it's a level playing field.
Yeah, and in Mexico, it's not just... I mean, we always focus on supermarkets, don't we? Because I don't know about you, but that's where I get the majority of the plastic bags from. But it is everyone. It is... I mean, I bought a load of stuff, let's be honest. I bought myself a very nice pottery guacamole bowl. Things like that. When you're shopping in markets, it is
when
absolutely...
It was your birthday, so, you know, why not treat yourself?
I bought myself a lot of jewellery too. That didn't come in paper bags. It came in some very nice boxes. But it's absolutely everything. So it's not just the groceries. It is the clothing shops. It is the shoe shops. Absolutely everywhere you go, there are no more thin single-use plastic bags. And it is working. And single-use plastic in general, I think if you just say niet, then... your coffee shops and all the rest of it will come up with a solution. Starbucks and Costa aren't going to stop selling Frappuccinos for 6 months until they come up with a different solution to the plastic coffee cups at the moment. They'll come up with something, and pretty fast.
We speak with one voice on the Business Breakfast, and it looks like the supermarket community does. If you have a different view, if there is a defence of plastic bag league out there and you're the spokesperson, get in touch, 4001, or use the app. But I cannot see a reason for still having them. Very quickly, Airbnb. You've two bits of research you've been doing on Airbnb. One, you've lived in an Airbnb for the past 3 weeks. But secondly, there is new research out.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Coming out from a university, having a look at which ads are the most trusted on Airbnb. I stayed in three while I was travelling, including a shared co-working house, which was great. Met a lot of really, really interesting people. Researchers have been looking at Airbnb ads and seeing which hosts are considered the most trustworthy. It's not the online ratings that cause the trust. It's not the reviews that are making the trust. It is the pictures. Women are considered more as hosts more trustworthy than men. Older hosts are considered more trustworthy than younger. And if you smile in your little Airbnb host photo, you're more likely to get guests than if you don't.
That works.
It works. Older smiling female. Also, attractive older smiling female.
Oh, really?
Because attractive hosts are also considered to be more trustworthy than unattractive hosts.
That's where it gets a little bit creepy. But your experience, okay, give us the 5-star rating overall for 3 weeks in Airbnb.
Oh, look, I'm a fan anyway. I like being able to cook and all the rest of it. It's the first time in a long time that I've done a sharing one, though, and it really, really worked for me. Met a lot of fascinating people. You've got people to go out for dinner with. You've got people to do stuff with. I'd do it again. And I'm not usually a sharer of... I mean, you had your own sort of suite, but then you were sharing common areas and there was a load of sort of, you know, workbenches and Wi-Fi-ness and a really good coffee machine, actually. Which
important.
Was a bonus. And a lot of economists and students, architects. There was a graphic designer there. I feel like I got... And a lot of them were Mexican as well, from different states. I feel like I had a far, far better, far more immersive holiday because of it.
So, the secret to travelling in Mexico, co-working Airbnbs and a Barcelona Football Club branded credit card, and you are away.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk futuristic farming now, because this week the great and the good of the modern agriculture industry gather in Dubai for an event called Agra Middle East. One of the pioneers of futuristic farming in the UAE in this region is the co-founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms, Sky Kurtz, and he's with us in the studio. Morning, Sky.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
So you've already got proof of concept. You've been growing tomatoes and other things in the desert for over a year now. What new innovations can we look forward to at this event in Dubai? What's new and exciting in the world of futuristic farming?
Well, I think the movement in agritech or ag tech investment is a big theme right now. In fact, just released were the statistics from 2019 investment at over $19 billion of capital invested in the ag tech space. This is growth year over year, and certainly growth since when I started in this space a couple of years back. Big themes are precision farming, So the use of various technologies to improve both the visibility and efficiency of farming methods. And that includes everything from things like drones flying over fields to do imaging analyses that help to inform more efficient either pesticide or chemical use, or even to allocate automation in tractors, things like this. There's also, I would say, other big themes are vertical farming and what we do, what's called controlled environment agriculture. And there are many flavors of that. There's high-tech greenhouses, vertical farms, which are kind of the warehouse farms with artificial light that you see. And then what I call repackaged vertical farms, which are vertical farms inside a container or maybe inside of a small fridge that you would see inside of a restaurant or a grocery store in, say, Germany, where they're taking off. So I think there are several themes in precision ag, controlled environment ag, and just the use of kind of software, sensors, and technology to farm differently and to improve efficiency and the quality of fresh produce.
What does it do to the cost, Sky? Because all of that sounds pretty expensive.
It depends. So certain technologies are expensive. To date, vertical farming is more expensive than field farming. And you see that vertical farms traditionally compete in greens, right? Specifically and almost always only greens. What nobody knows is the reason why is greens require very little light. And when you're using artificial light, you need to invest in not only the lighting systems, but the climate systems to remove the heat and energy produced by the lights. Then there's the energy itself, all of the capital of all of those requirements. Now, it comes with great quality and great efficiency, but at a cost. However, of course, they're investing in further automation in getting their solution cheaper. However, in other areas like precision farming, for instance, they're actually driving efficiencies well in excess of the cost of the technology deployed. And an example I mentioned were drones. They're using drones to even inform where rainfall patterns have hit range farming, and that can tell a shepherd where to send its animals to get optimal feed. The cost of the drone is a fraction of the gain achieved by sending the animals to feed in the right places. That's an example. Also, I co-founded a company called Vents. We put collars on cattle and sheep that semi-automate rotational grazing. So we have a collar that can shepherd the animal anywhere. We essentially have an app that controls that animal and projects a virtual fence, hence the name Vents. And we're able to control animals, reducing both cost and increasing the precision and accuracy of the knowledge of the animal because you have its biometrics when you're around its neck.
So what's next in terms of what we can grow here in the UAE or Saudi Arabia? I'm looking at your website and you proudly boast that we are currently growing 3 tasty tomato varieties. I've tasted them. They're lovely. We can buy them in supermarkets. But honestly, if we look at the UAE, Saudi Arabia's food sustainability programs, some tasty tomatoes are not the solution. They're a prototype, they're proof of concept. In 3-5 years' time, when we've got advances in technology, what other types of vegetables can we be growing here, or fruits?
Yeah, so even with my company, Pure Harvest Smart Farms, we are diversifying, right? The tomatoes was a proof of concept and partly done because it's one of the biggest pieces of the fresh produce buy, so proving a big piece of the market, but also one that's hyper-competitive, that where you have local production seasonally of a lower quality, but it exists. You have regional production from places like Jordan, and you have imports from everywhere from North Africa, like Tunisia, Morocco, or from Europe, the more premium products from places like France, Spain, and Holland, of course. So we wanted a prototype in a very competitive market to prove that we could be competitive in creating a new category, premium local, using better production methods to make very high-quality produce locally. And so to what we're going to be producing, we'll be moving into lettuces, microgreens and herbs, as well as into strawberries this year. And then we can produce just about anything that grows in a Mediterranean climate. But to your broader point on a food security strategy for these regions, I don't believe, like if you look at the calorie pyramid, there's fresh produce, and fruit and veg would fall in that. But then you also have all the carbohydrates, which is the bigger piece of your calories and grains, legumes like beans. These should not be produced in controlled environment ag. And the reason I believe why, it's they're extremely water-intensive crops that need to come from places that are abundant in water. But more importantly, it has to do with transportation costs. In the end, these are fungible commodities. They need to be produced where they're most efficient and where the lowest cost but technically acceptable solution can arrive to feed humanity. And things like rice, you can produce that. You can silo it. You can dry it, grind it, silo it, and ship it in extremely efficient ways, right? Huge, huge shipping containers of this, where the cost of transport is only a fraction of the final value of the good. If you do that with something like rice, you can then silo that here for months of storage for a food security strategy. Not true of a perishable fresh produce. So my belief is that many things will be produced locally, like perishable fresh produces, but not things like rice and corn and grain, which can be shipped in a global market, stored, and there can be food security strategies that involve logistics solutions, not necessarily production solutions.
Fish farming. We've seen that growing here in the UAE. We know there are, again, we can walk into supermarkets and buy salmon that's been farmed in Jebel Ali. Is that something that you as an organization would be looking at?
A very interesting question. The answer is yes. Not as Pure Harvest Smart Farms, but we as a group, the people that have founded and built this business, are very actively looking at this space. And we know a thing or two about it. That is also a category where you will see significant growth. Flying, you know, growing salmon or farming them in Norway or anywhere around the world, and then freezing them and flying them here has incredible cost and losses, of course, in freshness, quality, etc. Controlled environment ag solutions for growing fish makes a ton of sense. It's very similar to actually fruit and veg, surprisingly. Why? It's about climate control. It's about creating and replicating the environment that that animal naturally grows in and experiences.
Sky, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Great talking to you as ever. Middle East Agra is happening this week. We'll have more on this subject throughout the week on the Business Breakfast. But for now, Sky Kurtz, co-founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.